There was an insurance salesman who was sitting at his desk when he received a phone call. There was a lady on the other end of the line, and she asked him, "Sir, do you sell homeowners insurance?" And he said, "Well, of course I do. I'd be happy to help you." Well, there was a pause, and she said, "Well, can I purchase the insurance over the phone?" And he says, "Well, no, ma'am, I'm sorry. I'll have to come out and take a look at your house." She said, "You better hurry, it's on fire." Heard of the man who had gone to get a physical examination, and he was supposed to report to the doctor the next day to get the results. When he walked in and sat down at the desk, the doctor told him, said, "Sir, I have some bad news for you, and I have some worse news for you." He said, "Well," he said, "how about the bad news first?" He said, "Well, sir, the bad news is that you've only got 24 hours to live." He said, "24 hours to live? How do you think I can get my affairs together and be ready to die in 24 hours? He said, "Bad news." He said, "What could be worse than that?" The doctor said, "I was supposed to tell you yesterday." Timing is a very crucial element in life. Solomon discovered that timing is very important. And just as God has created the year with different seasons, God has created the cycle of life with different seasons. There are different times for this, there are different times for that. There's the summer times of life, the winter times of life, the springs of life and the autumns of life. And one of the keys to living life successful, according to Solomon, is by recognizing the season that we're in and ordering our lives according to that season. He tells us in verse 1, "To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to sow, in other words, and a time to reap the harvest, a time to kill and a time to heal." I have always heard and believe it's true, time heals all wounds. Time is a great healer. I also heard of a man who was striking his company, and he was a striking worker walking the picket line. And he held up a sign that said, "Time heals all wounds. Time and a half heals them faster." So there's a time for healing, a time for mending. He says there's a time to break down and a time to build up. There's a time when an organization needs to be organized, needs to be built up, and needs to exist in order to tackle a specific problem. There are other times when organizations need to be dismantled. They've outlived their usefulness. And so there's a time to build up, there's a time to tear down. He says there's a time to weep, and there's a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. Now, again, it's important that we recognize what time or what season that the Lord has us in and live our lives accordingly. You know how awkward it is when everyone's in a jovial mood and in walks a gloomy face. In walks a Scrooge. And now he can throw a damper on the party. And yet at the same time, how inappropriate it is to there to be something heavy come down, a tragedy, a terrible situation, and people are mourning and grieving over it, and then in walks somebody trying to crack jokes and trying to make fun. You know how inappropriate that is. It's important that we recognize what time it is. What's the season? What is God saying to me at this time, this juncture in my life? And how can I live according to the season? He says there's a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones. Now, stones are plentiful in Palestine. As a matter of fact, stones are one of the primary building materials. There are so many of them. The tour guides in Israel will tell you that When God distributed the stones around the world, He gave them to a specific angel. And He told them to distribute them evenly across the globe. But as the angel started out on his mission, he tripped, and they all spilt in Palestine. It is indeed a rocky area. There are stones everywhere. As a matter of fact, when we were on the Mount of Olives, we learned of an interesting law in Israel. As we were looking down the Mount of Olives, we noticed the graveyard that's there on the Mount of Olives, and we noticed that on the graves were stones, just rocks that had been laid on the graves. We were told that it's a law in Israel that you're not to put flowers on a grave, but that you decorate graves with rocks. This allows for the poor people to honor their deceased loved ones and show them the same kind of respect and the same kind of honor that the rich can afford to do. If they allowed flowers, only the rich could buy them, and so it would appear as if only the rich were honored and were loved by those that they had left behind. So because rocks are so plentiful, you can really judge the degree to which someone was missed by the number of rocks that are lying on their grave, whether they be rich or poor. So he says there's a time to cast away stones. There's a time to gather stones. He says there's a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. Now, you know, a hug is one of those warm, wonderful expressions of love. One of the great thrills of life is to be embraced by someone that you love and someone that loves you. I heard it said of hugging, hugging is healthy. It cures depression and reduces stress. Hugging is all natural. It's organic, naturally sweetened, and contains no pesticides or preservatives. Hugging is practically perfect. It has no breakable parts, no batteries to wear down, requires no periodic checkups, requires a low energy consumption, and has high energy yield. Is inflation-proof, non-fattening, no monthly payments, no insurance requirements, non-taxable, and of course, is fully returnable. Here's the hugging. Hugging is a wonderful thing, and here at Calvary Chapel, we do hug each other a lot. We like to express the love of the Lord to one another. And yet, there is a time to hug, and there is a time not to hug. And you know, if we're just always hugging each other and there's no discretion involved, well, then the hugs become meaningless. There's an appropriateness. There's a time to hug. There's a time not to hug. And when you know that people show some discretion, then their hugs become more meaningful. And when someone reaches out and gives you a hug, you know it really, they're not just going through the ritual, but they're really meaning it. They're really loving you and caring for you. So there's a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. Please, if you meet me at the mall and if one of you fellows see me at the mall, don't run up and give me a big hug. That's not the time I like to be hugged. Out of context, it can be misunderstood. So it's a time to gain and a time to lose. You know, there are times when we have to take one step backward to take two steps forward. It's a time we have to lose a little bit in order to gain. There's a time to keep and a time to throw away. Here is a biblical basis on which to have your next garage sale. There's a time to tear and a time to sew. Now, I'm sure he's not talking about breakaway football jerseys here. He's talking about the ancient practice of tearing the garment. Whenever you were confronted with blasphemy or ever you were confronted with a great loss, in order to show grief or mourning, they would tear or rent their clothes. And so what he's saying essentially is that there is a time to cry and grieve. And yet there's also a time to dry your tears and get on with life. Life is passing you by. It's time to move on. He says there is a time to keep silence. And there is a time to speak. Just this past Sunday, I met an old friend of mine, and I wanted so much to share the Lord with him. But as I was talking to him, every chance I was going, every opportunity I had to insert something in the conversation about the Lord just kind of, you know, put his hand on me and said, I want you to be silent. Now's not the time. And I fought it. It was so difficult. I don't want to share you with him, Lord. I want to really speak to him and invite him to church and all. And yet the Lord made it clear to me, no, you need to be silent right now. Just renew the acquaintance. Later on down the line, I'm going to open up an opportunity for you to share when the time is right. And so, you know, we'd all do well to heed this one. There's a time to keep silent. There's a time to speak. Wives, understand that there's a time to speak and there's a time to keep silent. If you've got a major problem you want to discuss with your husband, 30 seconds after he walks in the door is not the time to do it. You know, let him sit down at the table, let him eat his meal, let him read a little bit of the paper, kick his shoes off a little bit, and then hit him with it. But 30 seconds after he walks in the door is not the time to speak. There's a time to love and a time to hate. There's a time of war and a time of peace. You see, God has ordained various times for various activities. There is a time and there is a season for everything that God's will includes for your life. You don't have to get impatient. There is a time, there is a season. And if you will wait, and if you will trust the Lord, that season will come. It's said of the successful farmer, he knows that nature works for him only if he works with nature. And this is also true of a successful life. We become successful when we identify the time and the season that we're in, and when we cooperate with the season that God has us in. You know, so often we are like the foolish farmer, you know, who wants to reap the moment after he sows. And so because he wants to reap a crop, he fails to sow the seed. He doesn't realize that when it's time to sow, that's what you need to do. And when it's time to reap, that comes later. You see, so often in our own lives, we try to rush God's processes. You know, you might love summertime and yet hate wintertime. And so in defiance of God, you grab your swimming suit, you put it on, you grab your suntan lotion. You go down to the beach to lay out in the sun in the middle of January. I hate winter. It's summer. I like summer. I'm going to go down to the beach, lay out and get a tan. Well, you can fight against the seasons if you want, but you're the one that's going to get hurt. You're the one that's going to catch pneumonia. There's some of us that are single, and you hate being single. You want more than anything in the world to be married. And so you're spending all your time longing to be married while you're missing the joys of being single. You're not taking advantage of the season that you're in. Some of you are in a time of sowing. You're just starting out in your career. You're having to work long hours. You're getting all of the leftovers that nobody else wants to do. You're getting all of the projects that everyone else hates to do. All of the crumbs are falling to you. You're having to pay your dues, and you hate it. You want to be harvesting the crop. You want to see the spoils of your labor. But now's not the time. Now's the time to sow the seed. You see, don't fight God and where God has you in your life. Cooperate. Learn the lessons God is trying to teach you. And in due season, He will move you on to better things. So be patient. Just trust the Lord. He goes on and he says, "What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time." Isn't that beautiful? God makes everything beautiful in its time, when the time is right. God is a master painter. And he is working on his masterpiece. He's painting on the canvas of our lives. You don't rush a master painter. You let him take his time. Every brush stroke is meaningful and purposeful. There are no accidents. Every brush stroke is deliberate. And you look at the canvas before it's finished and you say, wow, this is a mess. This is a blur color. And yet the master painter knows what he's doing. Trust him. He makes everything beautiful in his time. God's workings in our lives are like a fine wine. They can't be appreciated until they come of age, until they have time to season. Then they taste. They reach their best taste and finest taste. He says also he has put eternity in their hearts. Now this is perhaps God's finest work. For in each human being, God has placed a tugging. He has placed a longing. A frustration that can only be satisfied with a touch of eternity. This is the hunger in the human heart. That beyond time, we are hungry for eternity. There is a sense in each one of us that this life is not all there is to it. That this life is not enough. And there's a hunger, there's a stirring in each one of us that reaches out for the life to come. A life on a higher plane. A greater dimension of living. It was said by Henry David Thoreau, "Time is but a stream I go a-fishing in. I drink of it, but while I drink, I see the sandy bottom and detect how shallow it is. Its thin current slides away, but eternity remains." There is an eternity. There is a longing for eternity, the tug of eternity in the heart of every human being. In the human psyche, there remains an unconscious memory of the joys of the Garden of Eden, the paradise that man once inhabited. We remember the garden. We long for a paradise, a place where all of our problems would be over, a time where all of our pleasures would be satisfied. We long for the garden. Whenever we use words like, "that's not the way it should be," or "I would rather have this," or we're all expressing that tugging, that longing. There's got to be more to it. There's a standard out there. There's a world out there. And it's this disgruntlement, this dissatisfaction, this lack of fulfillment that points to a profound truth. The reason we're made this way is because this world is not our home. We have been designed for the garden, and we'll never be satisfied until we get back there. We have been constructed for eternal pleasures, and therefore the temporal pleasures of this life will never be enough. This is why so many of our dreams are never realized. This is why life's pleasures are never enough. This is why even when all is well, we still can't get along with ourselves. We don't experience peace in our hearts. It all illustrates the same truth. This world is not our home. We were made for eternity. We were made for heaven. He says in the next portion of the verse, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. You see, there is a longing for eternity in our hearts, but we can't find the way back to the garden. We can't find the way to heaven. We want heaven. We have heaven in our hearts or desire for heaven in our hearts, but how can we find our way back? The Garden of Eden, sadly, is not on any auto club atlas. It's not on any map. As a matter of fact, when Adam and Eve sinned, they were barred from the Garden of Eden, from this paradise. It was paradise lost. And ever since then, the story of humanity has been man's attempt to regain that paradise that he lost. And yet this is the frustration. The eternity that he senses in his heart, he cannot find on earth. There's a frustration. The temporal pleasures don't satisfy the eternal tug. This is the source of Solomon's theme. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. He says, I've looked out on life under the sun as it exists apart from God. I've tried to find some kind of eternal meaning and eternal purpose in life, and I've struck out. Life is nothing more than chasing soap bubbles. Just about the time you think you find it, it pops and it dissipates and you're left with nothing. Life is futile. Life is frustrating. As far as I can see it under the sun. But you see, here's what Solomon doesn't tell us, or he doesn't tell us until the very end of the book. And that is that there is only one place where man can find fulfillment, and it's not under the sun, it's above the sun, it's in God. It was St. Augustine who said, Lord, Thou hast formed us for Thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in Thee. God is the source of our satisfaction. Only God can satisfy your heart. Take whatever you like and feed on it. Try to cram it inside. Get as much of it as you can and it'll never satisfy. You'll thirst again. Only God can truly satisfy the emptiness you feel in your heart. It's been said that the soul of man is made with sweet tastes and only God Himself is rich enough to delight it. Only God Himself is rich enough to satisfy the sweet tastes of your soul. Life is not meaning in life, purpose in life, is not found under the sun. It's found in the sun, the S-O-N, in Jesus Christ. He says, I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Now, since real life is not found in temporal things, since it's not found in things found under the sun, but since it's found in spiritual things, how should we handle the temporal aspects of life, the physical things of life? Should we remove ourselves from them? Is the spirituality that God desires an asceticism where we remove ourselves from the physical things? We go off into a monastery, we live in a monastery and try to separate ourselves from the natural comforts and pleasures of life. Is that the kind of spirituality that God desires? No, that's not it at all. Solomon says, yes. You know, things under the sun are worthless in and of themselves. But nevertheless, they're gifts of God. And so enjoy them. Make the most of them. But just remember that they are not what life is about. That there's more to it than the gifts of God. That there's God Himself. And that only God Himself can satisfy your soul. What Solomon is saying is enjoy God's gifts. Enjoy the pleasures of life. But just don't allow the pleasures of life and the gifts of God to get in the way of the giver. Don't expect out of the gifts what you can only receive from the giver. You see, we expect too much out of life. That's our problem. We approach our career as if our career is what's going to satisfy us and build up our self-esteem and make us feel worthwhile until we achieve a measure of success and wow, is this it? Man, you think that when you get married, that's going to be it. That'll be the end of your problems. You'll live happily ever after. And then when you get married, is this it? If I can just get that new job, all my problems will be over. And you get it. Is this it? You see, enjoy life, but just don't expect more out of it than it can give. Sure, the blessings of God are nice. They're wonderful. But they're just blessings. They're not the blesser. And only God Himself can satisfy the needs in your heart. What Solomon is saying to us in many ways is, hey, lighten up. Enjoy life. Don't take life and its problems so seriously. I mean, a lot of life is just not that important. We get so bent out of shape. We're trying to stay on top of things. We're trying to make sure everything goes well. You know, we want every T crossed and every I dotted in our lives. We're meticulous in detail. And yet, hey, what's the big deal? Let me say to you, you're always going to have problems on the job. You're always going to have problems at home. You're always going to have problems with your car. You might as well face it. So why get bent out of shape when problems crop up? I mean, you know, sometimes we live as if we're trying, our goal is to eliminate all the problems in our lives. When that is a futile goal, that'll never happen. You need to lighten up. And just enjoy the life that you've got. You know, rather than trying to eliminate all the problems, just take the blessings that God has given you and enjoy them to the fullest. Enjoy a good meal. Take a walk in the park. Spend an evening at home with the kids. Enjoy the smell of a new car. Or the beginning of baseball season. Or big fat tax refund. Just enjoy the little blessings that God gives you and make the most out of life. But just don't expect more out of it than it can give. Enjoy it for what it is. It was Paul who wrote, God gives us richly all things to enjoy. God wants us to enjoy life. He wants to bless us. It's interesting that the Jews read the book of Ecclesiastes during the Feast of Tabernacles that occurred during the fall harvest. And it commemorated how God had provided for them during their wilderness wanderings. It was a time of celebration. It was a time of rejoicing over what God had provided. You know, we're so worried about making our lives perfect and eliminating all our problems. We're so concerned about what life can give us and what life hasn't given us yet and what we want out of life that we can't enjoy what we do have. So what Solomon is saying, lighten up. You know, just give it a break, you know. Don't get bent out of shape trying to stay on top of things. Life's not that important. It's life not under the sun, but it's life above the sun that's going to bring you satisfaction and true fulfillment. So just enjoy life here, you know, when you've got it and while you've got it to experience it, and keep your focus on things above. He says, I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before Him. That which has already been, and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. Now, God's works are final. God's works are permanent. Remember that God is timeless. He exists outside of time. In other words, God sees the end from the beginning. God sees all of time as one big picture. And therefore, when God does a work, He's not subject to the limitations of time. When God does a work, He not only begins the work in time, but He also assures the result of what He's just done. He works on both ends of it. He initiates it, and then He assures the results of it. When we work, we are constrained by time. You know, we're not like God. We're not timeless. We're not sovereign. And so when we begin a work, that work is subject to the constraints of time. God can veto that work. God can judge that work if necessary. God can thwart its results and ensure its failure, or He can ensure its success. It's subject to God. and to the constraints that God has placed on us. We are also responsible to God for the works that we do. Now, God is not responsible to anybody. Can God sin is the question that people ask so often. There's no such thing as sin to God. God is the one who makes the rules. So how can He ever break the rules? Whatever God does is the rule. It is the standard. And that's why whatever God does, it's permanent. It's secure. It's final. But we're subject to God's veto. We're subject to God's, you know, jurisdiction. And we're going to be held responsible for the works that we do. He says God requires an account of what is past, of what we do. He says, moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. And in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. Now, Solomon was a wise ruler, and we know that he was fair with the people. But apparently some of his subordinates were not. And so there were corrupt men that were in positions of judicial responsibility. And they were perverting justice in order to pad their pockets. It's sad, but that seems to be the ethic of our day. The ethic of Washington. You know, whatever pads my pockets, that's what becomes right. And it's just sad to see the injustices around us, in our judicial system, among our lawmakers. I heard of a lawyer who had written a will up for a little old lady. And he said, okay, ma'am, that'll be $100. So she fumbled around in her purse until she got the $100 bill out, and she handed it to the lawyer. The lawyer took the $100, and as he did, he kind of felt that there was another $100 bill stuck to the bottom of the one that the lady had given him. She didn't know it. Immediately, the ethical question popped into his mind. Should I tell my partner or not? That seems to be the ethics of the day. You know, whatever will pad my pocket. Solomon said in his heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there shall be a time there for every purpose and for every work. The judge and the lawmakers should be aware of the fact that one day they're going to have to stand before the judge and the lawmaker. He said, I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, God tests them, that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to beasts. One thing befalls them, as one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the beast, which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Now, in verse 21, there are some that believe Solomon is teaching a distinction between the destiny and the fate of the soul of man and the fate of the soul of the animal. That the animal, when he dies, his soul goes back to the dust. It just goes down to the earth and he no longer exists. Whereas the soul of the man, whether he's righteous or wicked, his soul goes to God in order to be judged. And so there are some that believe that. Now, if you've got a little puppy dog that died and you've been hoping that you can see that in heaven, see that little puppy dog in heaven, you know, you're kind of disappointed with that interpretation because it says that the soul of the beast just goes back to the ground and it no longer exists. I'm not sure that's what he's saying at all. I think that if you really study the passage in its context, what Solomon is saying is that, hey, looking at life from the human perspective, looking at life, quote, under the sun, apart from God, looking at life as it appears to the human eye. There's really no difference between what happens to the man and to what happens to the animal. And who really knows if there's an afterlife? Who really knows if when an animal dies, what happens to its soul? And when a man dies, what happens to its soul? In looking at death, he's approaching it very cynically. Like, all that I know is that the apparent fate of the man and the fate of the animal appears to be the same. They both go back to the dust and they cease to exist. It is true that empirically speaking, we cannot prove that there is an afterlife by what we see here on earth. There is no empirical evidence that supports the belief that man's soul is eternal, that man's soul will live on. As we see it, the soul of the man, the soul of the beast, do the same thing. They go back to the dust. It's over. That's it. The only way that we could really determine that there was an afterlife is if someone came back from that afterlife and gave us directions and gave us instructions. And then we could take his word for it. That's exactly what has happened. Jesus Christ died. He went the way of every man, and yet he rose again. The Bible says he ascended into heaven, leading the captives free. And then he appeared to his disciples, and he told us the way to eternal life, and that's through faith in him. The evidence that we have is not empirical evidence. It's not the kind of evidence that we can put under a microscope and discover. It's not the kind of evidence that we can travel and we can show you firsthand that there is a heaven. But we believe in an afterlife because Jesus taught us. And that Jesus is the one who conquered death. He came back from the grave. And he is the authoritative voice. We believe in the afterlife because it's taught to us in Scripture. And we believe in it because there is a tugging in our hearts that says that there's got to be more to it than this. So what Solomon is essentially doing is just sort of continuing his philosophy. You know, he's trying to seek life under the sun. And as far as life is concerned under the sun, as far as the average human being is concerned, given only what he can see with his own eyes, hey, what's the deal? Nobody knows. You might as well live and grab for all the gusto you can. You only go around once. He says in verse 22, you know, this is your heritage. How do you know what's coming in the future? This is your heritage, what's right here. So you might as well live it to the fullest. This is the philosophy that the world has adopted. This is the philosophy by which your friends live out. Friends at work, friends in your neighborhood. This is their philosophy about life. You only go around once, grab for all the gusto. And yet that philosophy, in my opinion, is a risky gamble. For let's say that there is no afterlife, just for hypothetical sake, there is no afterlife. Well, what have I gained by living my life for Jesus Christ? Great deal of joy. Forgiveness of sin. Peace in my heart. Love in my relationship with my wife. I get along with my wife. I get along with my kids. It's all because of Jesus Christ. It's a joy in my heart. No headaches. Or very few. Very few heartbreaks. Very few hangovers. Maybe after a hard Sunday when I've preached too much. But that's about it. None of the other kind of hangovers. What have I gained? Man, a great deal. What have I lost by believing in Jesus Christ and being prepared? I don't think I've been cheated out of anything. A few headaches, a few hangovers. That's about it. But let's say, on the other hand, hypothetically speaking, that there is an afterlife. And yet you've lived as if there isn't. What have you gained? A lot of hurt. A lot of heartbreak. A lot of hangovers. And what are you risking? A lot. An awful lot. You're risking your entire eternity. To me, that's a very risky gamble. To me, there's no good reason why you wouldn't want to give your life to Jesus Christ tonight. Makes sense. It's the best move. I think there is another lesson here that we're being taught. And that is that apart from God, human life loses its value. As he's looking at life under the sun, he looks and he says, hey, there's really no difference between the fate of the soul of man and the fate of the soul of the animal. They both go back to the dust. So what's the difference between them? And in any ideology that rules out God, you always see an ideology that devalues man. How does man gain his intrinsic worth? What is the basis of respect for human life? There's only one basis. And that is that man was made in the image of God. That the blood of Jesus Christ was shed for mankind. That and that alone gives human life value and importance. If you rule God out of your thinking and make man nothing more than a mere animal, well, then what is the difference between man and the dog down the street? Not a whole lot of difference. And you see the confusion that's resulting in our society. You got these people running around saving all these little seals and baby whales and stuff and spending millions of dollars to get three whales stuck out of the surf somewhere in Alaska or someplace. While people are starving. While they're killing innocent babies. And there's all this confusion, this distortion. Why? Because we've ruled God out of our thinking. Man has lost his value, his intrinsic worth. He's nothing more than a mere animal. Now, the sad thing, and the thing we're reaping in our society, is you tell man he's an animal, he's going to live like one. He's going to be governed by his glands, his instincts, whatever makes him feel good. He doesn't care about human life. Just as soon shoot you at the Burger King to pick up $15 out of the tray than to anything else. You tell man that he's an animal, he's going to live like one. You tell man that he's fallen from the image of God, he's going to seek to be restored to God, to find God. And so, there is a great difference between man and beast, but that difference lies in his relationship with God. And what Solomon is saying to us is that the meaning in life lies in how life relates to God. You take anything in life and separate it from God, take it apart from God, and it's worthless, it's meaningless. Your job, your family, your friends, your anything, it's really worthless when you really sit down and really analyze it. So we're here 60 years and we come, we go, what's the deal? We left a few things behind. And we had some relationships, but they didn't last. What's the big deal? Oh, it's all meaningless. It's all worthless. Man, when I read Ecclesiastes, if I didn't know Christ, I'd want to go out and blow my brains out. Really? It's all futile. What is it? Any meaning in it? Any purpose in it at all? Unless you see that God exists and that God loves us and God has a plan for our lives and that there are times and seasons that God has us in. He's put eternity in our hearts to draw us to Himself and we can have a relationship with God. And He does care about our lives and our relationships and our job and our family and our home and this and that. And He cares about these things, and because He cares about these things, that gives them meaning. But that alone gives them meaning. Life apart from God is futile, like chasing soap bubbles. He says, then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. Now, nothing creates a despair about life quicker than when we witness the injustices that abound. When we see that power is in the hand of the oppressor, we want to throw up our hands and just quit. It's been said that right is always on the scaffold. Wrong is always on the throne. And when we see a world where injustice abounds, where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, when those in power oppress the innocent, it causes a great disappointment, great discouragement. As Gary Preston said in Discipleship Magazine, life is a crushing disappointment because what we expect and hope to get from it doesn't really come. We expect righteousness and goodness to be the way to happiness, fulfillment, and prosperity. Instead, we find that the cheater gets the high grade on the exam. The liar is elected to office. The embezzler lives in the mansion and drives the Mercedes. The immoral man marries the beautiful woman. Ecclesiastes sees these contradictions and concludes that life is vanity, a devastating disappointment, a confounding contradiction. Notice what Solomon concludes. Therefore, I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. He said, man, when I saw the injustices in life, I figured it was better to be dead than to be alive. And after I thought about it, I concluded that, no, it would be better to just have never existed. And then you wouldn't have to experience all of the injustices and the inequities. It was the French skeptic Voltaire who said, I hate life, and yet I'm afraid to die. That's the feeling of a lot of people who are living apart from Christ tonight, who've tried to find meaning under the sun, and yet have struck out. And they live their life with this deep emptiness, this deep darkness inside. I hate life, but I'm afraid to die. It's sad that every year in our country, 400,000 people attempt suicide. 40,000 people succeed. They've hit life head on. And they've examined life. And they've concluded as Solomon did, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Life can be hard. Life can be brutal. Life can be confusing. But listen to this tonight. The answer is never by running away. The answer is never suicide. The answer is God. You see, one of the most difficult things about life is that God doesn't give us explanations for everything that happens. God is not obligated to answer all our questions. God expects His people to live on promises, not explanations. God says that if you know who, you don't need to know why. That's real faith. That's real trust. Do you trust God even when He doesn't give you an explanation? When things go wrong, when things seem unfair, do you get angry? Do you get mad? Do you get upset at God as Job did? Or have you learned to trust God? Do you know that He loves you and that He cares for you? And that all things are working together for good according to His purposes? That He makes all things beautiful in His time. That He's made you wonderful promises and that you're to hang on those promises rather than demanding explanations. This is where real faith comes in. This is where the rubber meets the road. Is, are you willing to trust who, even when He doesn't answer why? He says, again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Now, you know, he said, this is so sad. I worked hard, gone out, made my fortune. You know, the friends used to come over. We used to dream together. We used to talk about all that we were going to accomplish. And finally, I've gone out and I've made it in life. And now my friends resent me for it. Now they're mad at me because I succeeded and they didn't. In making his fortune, he lost his friends. He says, it's just vanity. It's not worth it. It's interesting that when you accumulate wealth, you accumulate a host of problems that come with it. Some of you guys that have the new automobiles, you live in bondage. Every time you drive into the grocery store, you worry about somebody pulling up next to you and throwing that door open and scratching your car. You live in bondage. You don't know the feeling of being free like I do. Man, I drive in the grocery store and I lay the keys out on the dashboard hoping somebody's going to steal it. But I don't care if anybody scratches it. Yeah, I run into the curb, run into the street poles, whatever, and just keep right on going, you know. Get hit, get the money, and keep right on rolling, you know. I mean, it doesn't matter to me. It's freedom, man. It's freedom, you know. It's just a joyous way to live. See, when you accumulate wealth, you accumulate a host of problems that go along with it. So you got those jewels, but you don't wear them anywhere. You're afraid they'll get stolen. And it's a catch-22. You know, you get a little money, and all of a sudden, your long-lost cousins come to see you. Suddenly, all the family wants to start making a visit. Everybody starts hitting you up for a loan. Solomon says, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. And he just concludes, hey, better is a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. He says, in retrospect, hey, I'd rather just have enough just to get by, just to feed my family with all the hassles that come with the fortune and the great wealth. He says, better is a handful with quietness than both hands full with vanity and toiling and grasping at the wind. Rather than live with peace and to have this great wealth and have everybody mad at him. You know, who can forget examples like Howard Hughes, who was so wealthy and his world revolved around holding on and protecting his wealth. And he ended up dying a hermit down in Mexico, shriveled up, no friends, no contact with the outside world because of his great wealth. He had to, in his desire to protect it, he stayed secluded and away from the rest of humanity. And it's sad. The rich man is always suspecting other people. Are you after my money? I think the worst thing in the world is to be rich and single. You never go out with a girl without knowing whether she's after your money or whether she really loves you. A lot of problems with being rich. And so I'd rather just have a handful of quietness, he says, than both hands full with grasping and toil. He said, and then I returned, and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. I like how the NIV puts it. This too is meaningless. A miserable business. Here's a guy who's been building his empire, working and working, making his riches. But in the process, he's had no time for relationship. He has no family, he has no friends. He's made all this money, but he has nobody to share it with, he has nobody to spend it on. He's never stopped to think, why am I making all this money? What am I going to do with it once I make it? He never takes time to enjoy it. He's so busy making it. Here's the career person who's so busy, 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 making his money. And yet, he's forgotten about his family. Doesn't have time for his family. Doesn't have time for his kids. Here's the career woman who's so busy making it in the business world that she finds herself past the childbearing years and she has no kids to share it with, no kids to leave it to. It's vanity. It's frustrating. What good is it to make it if there's no one to leave it to? What good is it to go through life working hard if there's no one to share the spoils of success with? If you have no friends, if you have no people close to you, no one to share things with, what's the purpose of life? A Jewish proverb states it, a friendless man is like a left hand deprived of the right. I want you to look around you tonight. Not just physically, not just here in this room, but I want you to look around you in your life. I want you to look at the car you drive, your house you live in, place where you work, things you value. I want you to look around your life tonight, in your mind as you sit here. Take an inventory. Now I want to ask you one question. What in your life now is going to be with you in heaven? What? Only one thing. Those are the people in your life. It's the only thing we have here on earth that we're going to have in heaven are the relationships that we've made. You see, what is life all about? It's about people. It's about relationships. First and foremost, our relationship with Jesus Christ. And then secondly, our relationship with each other. And yet so often the decisions that we make place people as our last criteria. We get offered a promotion. And so we leave our friends, we leave our church to pursue that dangled dollar. Forget about people. That people, that friendship is what makes life worth living. So what if you succeed? So what if you get all the money if you've got nobody to share it with? If you've got no long-lasting relationships? You know, I've spoken with quite a few men who've gotten to the stage in their life where they've been successful in business and have retired. And yet when each one of that man looks back on his life, the things that he recalls as his greatest joys are not the money that he made. It's not his accomplishments or his achievements. But it's the relationships that his work allowed him to make along the way. And when you go to a retirement party, nobody ever gets up and says how much the man made or what the man did. But one by one, they come up and the individuals share what that person meant to them, what a friend that they became, how close they were to each other. What really matters in life? It's people, it's friends. It's your family. And you see, let me say to you, if you're too busy for family and friends, if you're too busy for people, you're too busy. You're too busy. He says, so what if you've got all this and you've got no one to share it with? To me, one of the greatest incentives to get up in the morning and work for a paycheck is that I got somebody to bring it home to. If I didn't have anybody to bring it home to, I'd probably roll back over and go back to sleep. Verse 9, he says, for two are better than one. They're better in terms of working, in terms of walking, in terms of warmth, in terms of warfare, as we'll see. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. It's better to work with someone. It's better to have someone you can share the spoils of success with. That's why people go into partnership, because they don't like working alone. There's a joy in working alongside someone. The two can accomplish more than the individual can. Also, it's true in travel. He said, for if one falls, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Of course, in Palestine, the terrain was very rocky, and so it was very dangerous to travel by yourself. You could slip on a rock. You could hurt yourself. You could slide down a ravine and get lost. There were all sorts of dangers that were inherent to travel, and so it was always good if you were going to go someplace with someone else, so that if you did trip, if you did fall, somebody could help you back up. Somebody could go and get help if needed. And so it is walking through life. For life today is still dangerous. We still are called on to walk across rocky terrain. And if we're on our own, and there are people who, oh man, we got the Lone Rangers for Jesus out there. Don't need anybody, don't need a church, don't need any fellowship. They're just doing it on their own. But when those people fall, who's there to help them up? Who's there to strengthen them? There's nobody there. And oftentimes they don't get up from their falls. I am so thankful that I have you folks, that I have my wife, that I have my friends who are there to support me when I stumble, help me when I fall, pick me up when I fall down, you know, come to my aid when I need them, who are walking with me through life. I'm thankful for you. He says, again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Now, up to this point, he's been talking about a twofold cord, a relationship between two people. But now he says that a threefold cord will not be broken. Who is the third strand? It's God. You see, it is this third strand that gives the relationship, whether it be a marriage or whether it be a friendship. It is this third strand that gives the relationship its tenacity, its stamina, its toughness. So that when the pressures of life are brought to bear upon that relationship, so that when the stretching begins to occur, that relationship will remain strong. If it were just a two-stranded cord, man, it'd snap just like that. But it's that third strand that keeps it together. I am so thankful for the third strand in my marriage. Because Kathy would tell you, we probably would have been split and gone a long time ago had it not been for that third strand. Life is tough. The pressure that marriages are under today, the pressure that your marriage is under, is tough. We get stretched. We get pulled. It's so easy to want to hit the road and split, find somebody else. It's easy. That's why divorce is running rampant through our society. To me, I don't see how a marriage can really make it unless it's rooted and grounded in God. He is the third strand that gives it the strength and the tenacity, that allows it to snap back and it keeps it strong. Our lives, our marriage is a testimony to God's faithfulness and to His love. Many of you, your marriage is a testimony to God's faithfulness and His love. Because I know you. You're just like me. You're just as obstinate and stubborn and hard to live with as I am. And it's that threefold cord, the third strand, that keeps your marriage strong and healthy. And for those of you that are single and are contemplating marriage, make sure that you marry a believer. Make sure that you marry someone who knows the Lord and loves the Lord. And make sure that when you tie the knot, that there are three strands involved rather than just two. He says, better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king, who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Now, here he talks about the fickleness of popularity. He talks about a wise king who rose from poverty, became king, ruled wisely and faithfully, and yet a young man now has come along, a young man with a suspect background, a young man who's poor, and yet how quickly that the people have shifted their love from the old wise king to this new fella. And now they're cheering him, whereas once they cheered the old guy. And Solomon is saying, hey, you know, here's a king who's been faithful and all, and here's what he gets for it. First good-looking guy comes along with some kind of new slogan or new idea, you know, and they toss him out and they're off running after the new guy. Oh, the fickleness of fame. How fleeting is human opinion and popularity. You know, the same guys who are cheered one night, they strike out the next night and they're booed. The hero one night, the goat the next. How fickle popularity. I mean, take George Bush, for example. Who would have believed a year ago? Here is a president with the highest approval rating of any president in history. That one year later that he would be in a dogfight trying to get reelected. And I'm not justifying his policies or anything else. I'm just saying, just look at the fickleness of fame. Of popularity. The cheers of the crowd one day can turn into the boos the next. The same crowd that on Sunday cried, Hosanna, Hosanna, on Thursday were shouting, Crucify Him, Crucify Him. How fickle. Oliver Cromwell ascended to the British throne by conquering Charles I. One day he was standing in the midst of cheering crowds with a friend of his. As the crowds were cheering, he turned to his friend and he said, "Do not put your trust in the cheering, for those persons would shout as much if you and I were going to be hanged." The only approval worth seeking is the approval of God. Let me close chapters 3 and 4 with a quote from Warren Wiersbe, who in this quote sort of summarizes the two chapters. He says, "When Solomon looked up, he saw that God was in control of life and balanced its varied experiences. When he looked within, he saw that man was made for eternity and that God would make all things beautiful in their time. But when he looked ahead, he saw the last enemy, death, and grew cynical. Then as he looked around, he understood that life is complex, difficult, and not easy to explain. He despaired of life and thought it better never to have lived." Listen, when he looked up and when he looked in, there was hope. He found meaning. He found purpose. But when he looked ahead and when he looked around, he became confused and he despaired of life. And he said, "All is futile." Let it teach us where we need to put our focus. We need to keep our eyes looking up and looking in. And we need to avoid looking back and looking around and even looking ahead. When we look ahead, we look around, we get confused, we get in trouble. We look up, we look in. When we keep our eyes on God, there's hope, there's purpose, there's meaning.